Chapter 22 Coronet, Corellia. Taking two of the most famous people in the galaxy and smuggling them onto a highly developed security-conscious world was actually quite simple. Luke knew it would be, at least once, and so didn't bother consulting any of the many intelligence friends and allies he had, beyond arranging for identicards for himself and Mara. Now he stood in a crowded line at a crowded security station in the crowded Corellian city of Coronet and stared, smiling, down at the unamused, weathered face of an officer of Corsec, the system police. The man squinted up at him. "Luke Skywalker," he said. Luke nodded, his smile broadening. "I really don't see it."
"Oh, come on," Mara stepped forward, the voice raised in Luke's defense. "He looks just like him."
"Too short," the Corsec officer said. "No one would believe in a Luke Skywalker that short."
Luke let a slightly whiny note creep into his voice.
"I can do backflips just like him." "I'm sure you can."
The Corsec officer waved Luke's falsified identicard under the needle-like point of a data transmitter. A pinpoint light on the identicard switched from red to green, signifying that the visitor's visa for Emmerich Tovall, actor impersonator from Fondor, was approved. He was now free to enter Coronet and conduct lawful business of all varieties.
"Would you like an autograph?" Luke asked.
"No, thank you. Move along."
The disinterested officer took Mara's identicard next. Three places up in line, a couple who bore a remarkable resemblance to Han Solo and Leia Organa, as they had looked decades before, at the time of the Battle of Yavin, down to Leia's white senatorial dress and side-bun hairstyle, waited patiently at another station. The Corsec woman there looked skeptically at the screen in front of her and asked,
"Jayam Solo?"
"That's right," the Han impersonator said, his voice richer, more theatrical than the real Han's.
"Any relation?"
The impersonator shook his head.
"I changed my name for professional reasons."
"Does it help?"
"I get a lot of work. Here we're doing a bio-holodrama of the Solos with two endings, depending on whose side he takes in the upcoming conflict."
Just beyond him, the Leia impersonator patted her right-hand bun and spoke to the man in line ahead of her. Over the crowd noise, Luke could barely make out her softer tones.
"No, we're not married, but I've worked with him before."
"Well, yes, maybe.
Where are you staying?"
Mara bumped into Luke from behind.
"Move along, shorty. I've cleared customs."
Luke picked up his bag and moved toward the chamber exit, through which other visitors to Corellia were streaming. Inside the bag, its housing replaced by a more innocuous one, its power supply replaced by one far less potent, his lightsaber now resembled nothing so much as a personal glow rod and had passed through customs without raising an eyebrow, as Mara's had. The correct housings and power supplies, shipped separately, would be awaiting them at their respective destinations. "It worked spectacularly," he said.
"It did. Hiring the actors for the various other roles was the clincher, I think. Too bad your Chewbacca couldn't make it."
Luke shrugged.
"You can't always get a Wookiee at the last minute, especially when you have to dye his fur and give him a trim."
"Still," he allowed a false note of hurt to creep into his voice, "still, I think I make a pretty good Luke Skywalker."
"Of course you do,"
Mara said, her tone soothing, a millimeter short of condescending.
"So, before you began impersonating Mara, what was your real hair color?"
"Farm boy, you're asking for a beating."
Outside the customs facility, they posed for a holocam picture with two tourists who were delighted to meet Jedi impersonators. Once the tourists were gone, Luke and Mara kissed, put up the hoods of their traveler's robes, and went their separate ways. Mara fetched the airspeeder she'd rented under her assumed name and sped off toward a series of meetings where she'd pick up supplies and information she'd need for her mission. Luke, his day's activities as urgent but not as time-critical, waved down a public transportation groundspeeder and directed it to an address in one lightly trafficked area of the government districts of Coronet. The building that was his destination, actually three buildings down from the address he'd given the driver and where he exited the transport, was simple of design and pleasing to the eye. It was very low, one story only, on its right and left wings, but swept upward toward the middle in a steep curve, so that its center was a narrowing spire several stories in height. The entire building was duracrete, tan speckled with black, except for doors and windows of green transparisteel. It was set back from the street some 50 meters, the property decorated with dark green grasses sectioned off by narrow tan duracrete sidewalks, and was entirely surrounded by a fence of blue-black plasteel bars 4 meters high. On the fence gate was a printed sign reading, "Closed during planetary emergency. For help or information, please contact Corellian Security." Below that was a communications address. Elsewhere on the sign, hand-lettered, were phrases such as, "Jedi die," "Go home," and "Who places philosophy above planet has betrayed both." Luke recognized the last quote. It was from a recent speech by Chief Sal Solo. There was rubbish on the green lawn, and there were blaster scores on the walls and windows of the building side facing the street. Vandals had been at work. A uniformed Corsac officer walked the sidewalk in front of the fence, keeping her eye on pedestrian and speeder traffic. Luke walked past the Corsac officer, not making eye contact, the slightest gesture of his hand and exertion of the force keeping the officer from feeling any curiosity about the robed passerby. Once Luke was well past her, almost to the corner where the fence changed from plasteel to smooth stone and marked the beginning of a city library property, he glanced back. The Corsac woman was facing away. Another few steps and she'd turn and begin pacing back in Luke's direction. He took a quick look and feel around, detected no one's attention on him, and leapt over the fence. He came down, rolling to his feet almost silently, and dashed to the cover of the bushes along the side of the small Jedi enclave. The transparisteel windows along this side of the enclave looked as though they were permanently inset in the walls and could not be opened. But Luke stopped at the third window, looked around again, and brought out his comlink. He changed frequencies to one routinely used by Jedi on field operations, then whistled three notes into it. The window hissed as it unsealed. Cooler air from inside flowed out. Luke pulled at the window from the bottom. It remained attached, hinged at the top, and rolled through it, coming up on his feet in what looked like a small schoolroom beyond. The window sealed itself shut behind him. The room was darkened, but not dark. No glow rod supplied light. The only illumination came from sunlight through the viewport, tinted green by the transparisteel coloration. It revealed chairs and desks, too small for adults, and pictures all over the walls, diagrams showing the angles of attack and defense in lightsaber technique, long-dead Master Yoda, face furrowed in concentration, telekinetically holding an Old Republic gunship weighing many tons over his head, a female Jedi Master, generic and probably fictitious, not a person Luke had ever seen in person or in records, sitting cross-legged in meditation, her eyes closed. A silver protocol droid, powered down, stood at the head of the room, one arm raised as though to illustrate a point. The only sound to be heard was the hum of the enclave's air-cooling machinery. Luke shook his head, regretful. A Jedi teaching facility should never be so silent, so empty. But in the wake of the assault on Tralis and Centerpoint Station, the Corellians had declared the Jedi enemies of the state, and had made an effort to close down all Jedi facilities and round up Jedi in the planetary system. That last part hadn't gone so well. Determined not to let the teachings of the Order come as close to extinction as they had in the time of Emperor Palpatine, Luke had taught his students what he knew of avoiding hunters. He knew a lot. He moved to the door. It didn't slide open at his approach. He gripped the edge and gave it a shove. It slid aside on well-lubricated rails. Just beyond it, a silver lightsaber blade snap-hissed into life. The man who carried it said,
"You're going to find it hard to loot with both your arms cut off."
Luke grinned. "That's quite a greeting, Corin." The other Jedi turned his lightsaber off just as quickly as he'd powered it on.
"Luke! Master Skywalker!"
He stepped forward into the faint light admitted by the doorway. Corin Horn was about Luke's age and height, but a bit stockier of build, broader in the shoulder. Grandson of a famous Corellian Jedi of the Old Republic era, he'd come into recognition and training of his Jedi powers even later than Luke had. Careers as a Corsec officer and Rebel Alliance fighter pilot had come first. As conflicted as he might have been in early days about aptitudes, duties, and careers, he was now a Jedi Master, whose graying hair and beard gave visual support to his reputation as an elder statesman of the Order. He wasn't dressed as a Jedi now. He wore anonymous blue-and-white pinstriped coveralls, spattered with grease and hydraulic fluids, and a set of welder's goggles pushed up on his forehead. As he held out his hand for Luke, he looked like a pit mechanic ready to explain just how much his hyperdrive repairs were going to cost. Luke took his hand, an embrace of brothers-in-arms. "How's your family?"
"Good."
Corin's voice suggested he wasn't entirely happy.
"Mirax is under house arrest. Quite a flap over that, too. Some in the government want her expertise in smuggling critical materials into the system. Others don't trust her because she's married to a Jedi. So she waits at home, under arrest, every need being catered to by government personnel, enjoying a vacation."
He snorted.
"As for Valin and Gisela, well, I suspect you'd know better than I would what they're up to."
Luke nodded. Corin and Mirax's children were both Jedi, raised as much by the teachers of the Jedi Academy as by their biological parents, off doing the business of the Order. Corin's face softened.
"Thanks for not using them on the Corellian missions."
"That was an easy decision," Luke said. He moved forward, Corin stepping aside so he could enter the hall, and slid the door shut. Now they were in deeper darkness, illuminated only by dim emergency glow strips at the baseboards of this hallway. "I didn't want any Jedi to be considered traitors by their homeworlds. For most, it's nice to be able to return home from time to time." Corin didn't comment. Luke knew that he, Luke, was an exception to that generalization. His own homeworld of Tatooine held no lure for him. Hadn't in all the decades since he'd left it to find a new home elsewhere. Corin gestured down the hallway toward the rear of the enclave.
"I've set up one of the bolt holes as a staging area. Your lightsaber components are there. Also clothes, supplies, credits..."
"Thanks."
Together they walked down the hallway, and then down a spiral flight of stairs.
"So," Luke said.
"So."
"So what's the attitude of the Corellian Jedi? What do I need to know?"
They emerged from the staircase into another corridor that was lit only by emergency glow strips. Corin took three steps from the entry into the hall, then raised a hand, holding it against one wall almost at ceiling height.
"It's here," he said. A simple bolt and counterweight. Just give it a tug.
Luke reached out with the force, felt past Corin's hand, past the wall, to the machinery beyond. A weight suspended from a metal cable. A hole in the center of the weight. A crossbar that passed through the hole. Delicately, he drew the crossbar out of the hole and pulled down on the weight. A section of the wall rose smoothly into the ceiling. Light spilled out into the corridor. Beyond the wall section was a medium-sized chamber, tables laden with lit computer screens, wall lockers, four cots. They entered, and Luke released his hold on the weight. The wall section slid smoothly into place behind them.
"How do you do it?"
Luke asked. One of Corin's few weaknesses as a Jedi was his lack of ability with telekinetic disciplines. Corin couldn't, under most circumstances, operate the crossbar and pull-weight machinery.
"A backup system. Say, Halcyon Endures. That'll trigger the door. It uses battery power, though. I have a hand-crank device to keep the battery charged."
Corin shrugged. He sat at a chair in front of one of the computer tables and gestured at the items in front of the other chair. The housing and power supply for Luke's lightsaber.
"So,"
Luke said again. He sat, brought his false glow rod from his bag, and got to work reassembling his weapon.
"So you know my position. You accept the role and duties of a Jedi. You put the order and the general good ahead of planetary interests. Even family interests. Doesn't mean you cut yourself off from your family or world, just that you recognize that putting personal interests above the greater good basically constitutes maintaining attachments."
Luke slid the main lightsaber machinery out of the glow rod housing and set the housing and the feeble battery that belonged to it aside. In moments, he had his lightsaber reassembled. He turned it on experimentally, felt the heat from its green blade, and turned it off again.
"What about the younger Jedi here?"
"The ones who aren't Corellian are fine. Standing by. The Corellians, on the other hand, are
distressed.
Distressed at having to remain in hiding. Distressed at the fact that the government is trying to recruit them for anti-GA activities. Distressed at being considered potential spies and saboteurs. But they're holding to the Jedi bylaws.
For now.
For now. Let me ask you a favor. Transfer them out of Corellia. Get them out of this environment. Let them do their duty to the Order without having to choose between the Order and their homes, their families."
Luke nodded. Not an answer, but simply an acknowledgement that he'd heard Corin's words and recognized their gravity.
"And the children?"
"I don't know."
Corin's face was impassive, but his voice sounded pained.
"Taking them off-world would put them even farther from their families. Leaving them here would keep them in a potential danger zone, keep them looking between teachers and family members who represent divided loyalties. What's the right answer?"
Luke held out his hands, palms up. A "your guess is as good as mine" gesture.
"I think I'll arrange to get them off-world. Continue their education someplace more neutral, minimizing the degree of influence their attachments have on them. I'll make those arrangements today."
"How many young students do you have?"
"Only 5.
"That's not too bad. And speaking of attachments, Mara's going to be very unhappy if I don't have all my facts straight and errands completed before her mission gets underway. If she has to leave in a hurry and I'm not ready to go..."
Luke rose.
"I'll see myself out."
"May the Force be with you, Master."
"And also with you."
Mara decided that Thrakken Sal Solo's surroundings quite expressively reflected his mentality. He had a bunker mentality. He lived in a bunker. Perhaps he'd had more aesthetic sense and a prettier dwelling in the past, but if so, he had purged that weakness in his personality in recent years. Thrakken's estate, as unlovely as any Mara had ever seen in the possession of a major political figure, was a flat sheet of land a kilometer west of Coronet's government precincts. A blue clover-like plant grew on the grounds, and nothing else. No trees, no flower beds, no exotic carnivorous plants. Toward the center of the estate was its one building, a four-story monstrosity of blue-green painted duracrete. Had the arc of its exterior been more perfect, it would have been a proper dome, but it looked flattened, like a half-buried ball of immense size that had been sat on by a giant and partially compressed. There were several doors at ground level, all sideways sliding slabs of blue-green durasteel, two of them large enough to accommodate speeders, but there were no visible windows. It was said that instead of windows, Thraken had had the exterior riddled with holocams, and each interior room had screens on the walls that would display window-like views from those sensors. The estate was ringed by a high, gray duracrete wall, not too high for a Jedi Master to jump, but certainly high enough to silhouette a leaping intruder quite nicely. Mara knew from intelligence reports that there were pressure and movement sensors installed at random intervals under the ground cover, that the exterior holocams fed into monitors in Thraken's security chamber as well as the decorative wall displays of the rooms, that the complex had its own generators should city power lines be cut, that its water and waste processors were set up so that nothing above the size of a Kowakian monkey lizard could fit through the pipes and enter from underground. Mara had set up on the roof of a building across a broad but lightly traveled avenue from Thraken's estate. Ironically, the building, a flat two-story affair, whose simple, unmemorable architecture was still far more pleasing than that of Thraken's home, was a local precinct house of Corellian security. It had taken her very little time to scale the exterior and disable the sensors on the roof. Now it made an ideal position from which to spy on the estate opposite. Team Tauntaun, the Jedi strike team that had invaded Thraken's home at the same time Team Perella was attempting to kidnap Prime Minister Saxon, had faced the same difficult task, get inside without being seen. Galactic Alliance intelligence observers had provided information on the times and routes taken by Thraken when traveling from the government buildings to his home. Setting up in a drainage culvert on a blind curve on one side of that route, the three Jedi, Tahiri Vela, Doran Tainer, and Tew Zax, had leapt up against the undersides of the groundspeeders in Thraken's caravans, tucking themselves between the repulsor lift generators and hanging on by virtue of powerful magnets, and were conveyed into the bunker by Thraken himself. Or so they thought. It swiftly developed that, as with the assault on Prime Minister Saxon's home, the speeders were loaded with combat droids, the security staffs of the building alerted to the high probability of a Jedi attack. Two of the Jedi had fled. The third, Tew, now waited for nightfall in Thraken's home as Mara waited here. While the shadows thickened, Mara stretched out not too uncomfortably on the roof's edge, and listened to the conversations of Corsec agents as their words floated out from the windows below her.
"Say we just take everything we have to Trollis and blow them right out of their beachhead. Acceptable losses. Not a very popular position, but we don't really need a full-sized navy."
"Saw Terrani Alona's new holosquirmer. She has the most..."
"Continue to refuse to cooperate. We're going to have to..."
"If they were true Corellians, they'd never have let themselves be taken alive."
Full darkness fell, and a tiny green dot appeared halfway up the squashed dome of Thraken's home. It remained there for half a minute, and then disappeared. Mara checked to make sure her lightsaber and other equipment were in place. Then she rolled over the lip of the roof and fell two stories to the sidewalk, landing as lightly as a leaf fluttering to the ground. She held herself in a crouch, her dark robes making her all but invisible, and waited until there was no speeder cross-traffic to be seen. She came up out of her crouch like a sprinter and was across the avenue and up against the base of the featureless duracrete wall a moment later. A quick flex of the legs and boost of the force, and she was atop that wall.
Not quite.
She did not allow herself to come down on the wall top. It, too, was said to have pressure sensors on its walkway, and would reveal her presence if she did so. Instead, she caught herself with the force, creating a bubble between her and the top of the wall, and drifted just over that surface until she was above the blue clover on the far side. It was time to be a Jedi instead of a spy. As a spy, she'd probably have fixed a line thrower to the top of the Corsac building, launched a driller projectile, trailing a nearly invisible cable, to affix itself to the top of Thrakken's dome, and used a powered or hand-cranked winch to carry her the quarter kilometer from rooftop to rooftop. And even so, her chances of detection would have been very high. Instead, she carried almost no equipment, and her chances of detection would be determined by her own concentration. She allowed herself to float down to stand just above the blue clover. The bubble of force energy that kept her aloft was easier to maintain when she was mere centimeters above the surface. Merely having the mental image, the paradigm of it as a sort of air-filled balloon, improved her ability to perceive it, to maintain it. She'd need to employ all the concentration tricks she knew, because what she was about to do was very tricky. At the base of the wall, she stood a moment, eyes closed, and focused on the other things she'd have to do to cross 200 meters of sensor-filled open space. Air. She could not keep air from moving, of course. As she moved, she would displace it. But she added motion to the air she displaced, so that it moved out in a single stream, losing neither speed nor coherence for dozens of meters ahead of her. To a sensor, it would read not as the movement of a person across the lawn, but as a breeze. Heat. That would be the trickiest part. If she radiated heat, infrared sensors would inevitably pick it up. She surrounded herself with another bubble, this one of containment, and immediately felt her temperature begin to rise as the heat she expended stayed within centimeters of her skin. She could even control herself to the point that she did not sweat, and would need to do so here, but that, too, would increase her internal temperature. She couldn't sustain the effect of heat entrapment for long. She would end up collapsing, but she should be able to sustain it long enough to cross the open space between wall and bunker, and in that time, infrared detectors would not see her. Probably. She stepped forward, concentrating on the act of walking, reminding herself that the movement of her legs was only a comforting paradigm. Levitating in some other pose would require more of her attention. Each step felt a bit wobbly, as though she were moving across a flexible playground surface, but she fell into a regular pace and let her muscle memory do the work for her. Yes, any Jedi Knight might know one of these three techniques, most commonly the technique of levitation, but only a Jedi Master was likely to know all three or be able to sustain them simultaneously across such a broad distance. Mara bumped her nose into something hard and stopped. Immediately ahead of her was uniform grayness. She looked up along the curved surface of the bunker wall.
And only a Jedi Master is likely to become so focused that she walks into a wall, she told herself.
She swayed where she stood, suddenly dizzy from the heat.
Come on, Tew, she thought. You should have detected me by now.
A cord, millimeters thick, transparent, and almost invisible in the darkness, fell across her face. Hurriedly, she grasped at it, wrapped it around her waist three times, and gave it a tug. It hauled at her, and she walked up the wall, her arms trembling and legs increasingly faltering as the heat threatened to overwhelm her. An eternity later, she was 10 meters up the wall, and a wedge-shaped slit in the duracrete surface beckoned her. She stepped into darkness, dropped a meter to a hard floor, and landed badly, collapsing to the floor as her legs failed. She released the heat entrapment and felt the built-up energy flow away from her. With her last bit of strength, she held her control over the surrounding air long enough to send much of that heat streaming out through the slit in the wall, even as the slit slid closed. And then she burst into a sweat, a sudden head-to-toe sheen that felt like heavy motor oil against her skin. In the darkness, a female voice said,
"Goodness, you smell like a rancor after a foot race."
Mara smiled weakly.
"That's no way to greet a master. And you've never smelled a rancor after a foot race."
"Yes, I have."
There was a click, and brilliant light from overhead blinded Mara. She raised an arm over her eyes. As her vision settled, she could see she was in a tight chamber, narrower against the bunker exterior wall, but long. It was dominated by a neutral blue flying craft, a tubular vehicle like a starfighter, but with abbreviated fins instead of maneuvering wings. Its canopy, which opened at the rear instead of forward, was up. At the far end of the chamber, beside a circular hatch a meter in diameter, stood Tew Zax, with her hand on a control panel mounted on the wall. Short of stature, she stood a centimeter shorter than Leia, and was lean like most of her kind. She had pale blue skin, hair so pale that it seemed translucent, and delicate features dominated by eyes that seemed oversized. She wore the black pants and tunic of her Jedi outfit. Her boots, belt, and cloak were not in evidence. Mara struggled to a sitting position. Though tired and still flushed with heat, she felt much better already.
"What is this place?"
"A secret escape chamber."
Tew came forward and reached up into the vehicle's cockpit, pressing dashboard controls without looking. A side panel on the craft popped open. Inside, Mara could see bundled clothing, packaged field rations, items she couldn't make out. Tew reached for one of them and came forward to hand it to Mara. It was a transparisteel canteen.
"I think there are four of them in this building, but I haven't gotten at all of them. The entry is concealed on the other side. This and the other one I found both had two-person escape vehicles in them."
"That's very Thrakenish."
Mara took the canteen, unscrewed the cap, and took a long drink of its contents. Water, tasting slightly of its storage in a metal container.
"So first, Master Skywalker says good work on your staying here like this."
Tew beamed.
"Second, your report?"
Tew sat down, cross-legged.
"The short form? I've been here several days, have figured out how to patch a datapad into their internal holocam system, and beat my comlink whenever the area I'm in is about to fall under active observation. I've dived under more tables recently than you can possibly imagine."
Mara grinned and took another drink.
"Sal Solo isn't spending much time here," Tew continued, "which has given me several opportunities to enter his personal quarters. I've found equipment there I think is a master control set for this building's security and communications computers, but they're too well defended for me. They apparently require Sal Solo's biometric identification, which I didn't think to bring."
"I did."
Mara patted one of the pouches beneath her robes.
"What else?"
Tew shrugged.
"I've mapped out as much of this building as I've been able to visit, but I've concentrated more on not being discovered, which is tricky, as Sal Solo seems to be very paranoid and has security agents with mentalities to match his. I don't think I've been that effective."
"You've been very effective, but I think we've asked all we can of you here. You'll be leaving with me."
Tew smiled again and mimed a sigh of relief.
"All right," Mara said. "I'm going to rest for a while, until whatever time you think is best for a visit to Thrakken's quarters. That's when we go to work."